from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The body count in Tunisia is now at 18, following a siege by two armed men at a museum in the capital, Tunis. Prime Minister Habib Assid said the standoff was over. Freelance journalist Farah Samti was there and filed this report with RT late Wednesday.
What we know, according to the spokesperson of the Ministry of the Interior, is that three militants entered the building of the parliament this morning or late this morning, disguised as soldiers or wearing military uniforms. That's how they were able to get inside the building of the parliament and through it to the Museum of Bardo, which is right next to it. We don't have any further information so far about the nationality or the identity of the attackers. So far, we know that seven tourists were killed and one Tunisian citizen was killed as well. And we also heard that one security officer died at the hospital. He was injured and taken to the hospital, and he died there shortly after. There are between 15 and 20 people injured who were taken to the to two hospitals nearby in the same area. We were able to see helicopters around the area of Bardo, and they were helping the evacuation of people from the parliament and the those who were injured inside the museum. We know that there are still hostages at the moment, but also that the security operation is ongoing. It's not clear yet whether it was the museum that was targeted or the parliament or both, because both buildings are right next to each other, and the parliament was used as the entrance. So we are not sure yet. We know that they entered through the parliament and then went to the museum after. We heard some news that they were when the gunshots were heard around noon today, that maybe it's when the security forces found out that they were strangers or these militants inside the parliament, they chased them, and maybe they went inside the museum and held hostages. We don't know yet. It's not clear. But the Bardo Museum is a well-known tourist attraction. It's the biggest museum in the country, and again, its location is very sensitive, being right next to the parliament.
Well, it may not be four more years, but it seems things will stay the same in Israel for now. That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announcing what he called his party's great election victory against all odds, with Likud scooping at least 29 seats in the 120-seat Knesset, as nearly all votes in Israel's election were counted. Exit polls had earlier given arch-rivals Likud and the Zionist Union almost equal standing, with polls showing them either evenly divided or with the Zionist Union having a 3 or 4 seat advantage going into yesterday's election. Both Netanyahu and fellow Likud member Silvan Shalom said their party would seek to set a coalition government with other right-wing parties and ultra-Orthodox groupings. Although the Zionist Union's Isaac Herzog had originally refused to concede defeat, telling supporters early Wednesday that he would try to create the next coalition government, a real social reconciliation government, as he put it. This morning, Haaretz said he called Netanyahu, congratulated him for the election results, and, the Israeli paper noted, refused to explicitly say the Zionist Union wouldn't join a Netanyahu-led government. However, Zionist Union member of Knesset Stav Shafir said in a Facebook post, quote, "We will serve the people from the opposition," closed quote. Many of the Knesset candidates had focused on social and economic problems, such as the high cost of living. Herzog had accused Netanyahu of using scare tactics to distract public attention from those problems. That opinion was even shared by the New York Times editorial board, which Tuesday authored an op-ed piece saying, quote, "Netanyahu's outright rejection of a Palestinian state and his racist rant against Israeli Arab voters on Tuesday showed that he has forfeited any claim to representing all Israelis," closed quote. For more, we spoke with political analyst and commentator Eric Dreitzer about some of the implications of the apparent endorsement of the Israeli Prime Minister for another term. Tell me what you think the election means in the face of all of the polls and the embarrassing behavior of Netanyahu just prior to the election.
Well, it means quite a number of things. I think, first and foremost, as far as Israeli domestic politics goes, it signals that racism and white supremacy, Jewish supremacy in general, still really, for lack of a better word, reigns supreme when it comes to Israeli politics. If you saw Netanyahu's faction was in danger from, according to some of the polls, and so they immediately played the race card, really in the last days leading up to the election. And many analysts, I think quite correctly, have pointed to that as one of the primary levers by which they really marshaled a lot of their support, particularly from the radical right base that Likud really depends on for its success. So really, in many ways, I think it demonstrates that that continues to really be an entrenched part of the Israeli body politic. But I think also it really should call into question the notion of Israel as some form of a democracy in the region, because, of course, really part and parcel of this entire electoral farce is the inescapable fact that the vast majority of the actual residents of the country are utterly disenfranchised. And so if you really were to take these two things together, I think it becomes quite clear what Israel truly is, that it is an apartheid state, a racist state, that is in many ways a parallel to what we had in the Jim Crow South, what you saw in South Africa, and what you've seen around the world. And I think that this is becoming ever more apparent. Of course, the last people to realize it seem to be the Israelis and their American supporters.
Given that, and given the pronouncements by Netanyahu that there'll never be a Palestinian state while he's in charge, promising to allow more settlers into Palestinian lands, What does all of that portend in terms of developing a coalition government? What does it tell about the nature of the government we can expect?
Well, that the government is going to be an increasingly moving to the right, if that's fathomable, considering how far to the right it already is, that it is ever more extremist, and that it will continue to be relying on the most extreme fringe elements of the colonial settler project there in the occupied territories. And so as far as coalition building, I think it's still unclear exactly what sort of a coalition Netanyahu is going to attempt to build. But I think we should be very clear, and this is really I think directed mostly towards liberals and those pro-Zionists who consider themselves on the progressive left, those who were against Netanyahu, those who were for his opposition, they are also ardent Zionists. They are also supporters of the genocidal wars against Gaza, of the genocidal activity against the Palestinians broadly. And so while the actual politics of coalition building might get a little bit hairy, the ideological posture and the discourse in Israel remains very much one-sided. There remains a consensus, and the consensus is one of racism, of apartheid, and of colonialism. And quite frankly, this has really become the sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And I think that for those in the U.S., particularly Jews and supporters of Israel in the United States, especially those who consider themselves progressive, they are really the proverbial ostrich with its head in the sand. They want to blame things on Netanyahu, blame things on the actual politics of Israel, without actually considering the politics of Zionism and considering the real nature of what Israel is and has become.
In terms of domestic politics here in the United States, I'm wondering what the implications might be, given how emboldened Netanyahu was prior to his re-election, when it looked like he might actually lose. As you look around at the situation with Iran, where Netanyahu has, on a number of occasions, threatened to attack Iran, when you look at the relationship between Israel and some of the other neighbors, or particularly Syria, do you think that Netanyahu is going to be emboldened to go in the face of stated U.S. policy and become even more aggressive?
Well, there's no doubt about that. And I think in addition to that, Netanyahu is really going to run interference for the Republican Party. He's going to really be one of the primary means by which the Republican Party in the upcoming presidential elections in 2016 is going to articulate its foreign policy, that really it's going to be very much aligned with Israeli policy, which is, I think, quite obviously belligerent and bellicose towards all of its neighbors. And so I think that to a large extent, when it comes to U.S. politics, in many ways, it's going to be dictated to a large extent by Israel, by Netanyahu. Now, of course, there is also the fact that Netanyahu and Israeli politics, it trades in the currency of racism, and they've managed to paint Obama, who is certainly no friend to Syria, no friend to Iran, and no friend to the people of the region, but they've managed to paint Obama as some kind of a closet Muslim, as some sort of a lover of terrorism, as somehow, you know, less than his white counterparts. And so there is a fusion of this racist discourse within the sort of Republican AIPAC pro-Israel establishment in the United States. And I think that that's actually also going to draw the Democratic Party further to the right, as if that's even imaginable. So in effect, what you'll see then is that there will continue to be a pro-Israel consensus, and one that's going to paint Obama's administration as somehow being, quote-unquote, anti-Israel, when in fact they've really done almost everything they can to accommodate Tel Aviv and to accommodate the Israeli agenda. And I think that also when it comes to the regional aspect of this, they will continue their demagogy vis-a-vis Iran, and that will be both parties. And the political consensus in the United States is going to continue to be an imperialist one. And sadly, there won't be any change in the discourse, let alone the policy, when it comes to what the United States is doing in the region. And of course, Israel remains a steadfast ally and sort of, what should we call it, adjunct of U.S. policy.
And finally, given the fact that Representative Deborah Wasserman Schultz is the head of the Democratic National Committee, and she is one of the foremost preeminent Zionists in the United States, how exactly are the Republicans going to out Israel the Democrats?
Well, they're gonna out Israel the Democrats, to use that term, which I think is quite apt, simply by taking the more belligerent line. They will talk about Iran as an existential threat, not only to Israel, but to the entire region, to all of U.S. partners. They will basically attempt to smear, if one can use that term, smear any Democrats as being really toadies of the Obama administration, that whatever pitfalls that the Obama administration has fallen into, they will attempt to associate all Democrats with that. And that won't matter whether it's Hillary Clinton, whether it's even Elizabeth Warren, who postures herself as a real progressive Democrat, while at the same time continuing to maintain steadfast support for the state of Israel and Israeli policies. And so, as I said, the Democratic Party will, as far as the discourse goes, will continue moving to the right. They call it in the United States moving toward the center, but it's really moving towards the extreme right. And so, in effect, then, as I said already, you'll see this consensus growing, and you'll see the same terminology being used by both sides. And that terminology is very much dictated by AIPAC, by the Israel lobby, and by the neocon establishment. And when I say neocon, I don't simply mean a purely Republican neocon establishment. Neocon actually refers to members of both parties. There is an establishment that really works seamlessly administration to administration, despite whatever small fluctuations there might be. So when you think about what's coming in 2016 and you think about the election that's upcoming, you need to understand that Israel and the pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist agenda figure central for both party strategies.
Here in the U.S., another aspect of the nation's criminal justice system has come under scrutiny. Excessive prison sentencing, that is another example of American exceptionalism in fact. Mark Maurer, executive editor of the Sentencing Project, points out that while about 3,000 people sit on death row in the U.S., itself a world record by far, at least 160,000, or one out of every 9 inmates, are serving life sentences. Speaking with journalist Glenn Ford, Maurer said that although a 20-year sentencing maximum might sound radical to Americans, it's the norm in many parts of the world.
If you look at the United States compared to other industrialized nations, we lock up our citizens at 5 to 10 times the rate as those other nations. And, you know, differences in crime rates explain part of that, but only part. Most of it is that we are just tougher in our sentences than other countries. We have 3,000 people on death row in the U.S. and 160,000 people serving life sentences. That's 1 of every 9 people in prison. A number of countries in Europe have found life sentences to be unconstitutional, and those that still maintain it generally have a few dozen people, not tens of thousands, serving those kinds of terms.
Has it always been the case that the United States has handed down such draconian sentences compared to other places?
Well, we've had a higher rate of incarceration than most democratic nations for some time, but the scale of that disparity has really risen dramatically over the last several decades, the so-called tough-on-crime years, through mandatory sentencing, 3 strikes and you're out, cutbacks on parole release. Policymakers have adopted, you know, a range of policies and practices designed to both send more people to prison and keep them there for longer periods of time. And unfortunately, from my perspective, it's been very successful, and it's given us a world record prison population. So we really are distinguished in that area. And then many other nations, you know, look at our policies, you know, with a great deal of shock at what we've done in this country.
Wednesday, March 25th, we'll see a milestone reached in the development of an international independent media for the Western Hemisphere. Journalists and producers from the U.S., Mexico, Honduras, and Venezuela will join together to produce a 24-hour Spanish-language broadcast covering issues affecting the masses of people throughout the Americas. Here in the U.S., the effort is being led by veteran journalist Fernando Velasquez, executive producer of Informativa Pacifica, a daily Spanish-language newscast based at Pacifica radio station KPFK in Los Angeles. Velasquez spoke with us about the project from KPFK's North Hollywood studios via telephone Wednesday.
This is an extension of what Pueblos Sin Fronteras, a bilingual news program that we had for 3 years at KPFK, Pacifica Radio Los Angeles, did for a number of 3 years, in which we broadcasted live with the National Radio Network of Venezuela twice, with Rebel Radio from Paraguay, from FM La Tribu from Argentina twice, from Radio Progreso from Honduras once. We are repeating sort of the same thing this time around, but instead of doing one country at a time, we're doing, so far, we have lined up 3 countries, Venezuela, Honduras, and Mexico. The original idea was to talk about immigration and everything related to it, the remittances of money sent by the immigrants to their home countries, who makes money with those remittances, the human trafficking, who makes money exploiting undocumented workers, what's the role of undocumented workers in the labor force in terms of keeping wages down in the labor force in the United States, the collaboration of the private sector, the millions of employers that make money exploiting undocumented workers in every country, the organized crime figures in collusion with the Mexican authorities in Central America and Border Patrol in the United States, and the human trafficking and so forth. Then it was the proposal was advanced to the made to all to management first, and then to all the Latino producers at KPFK. They didn't quite like the idea of having been told what to talk about. Then Barack Obama decided to pass a law, a presidential decree, signed an executive order that makes Venezuela a national security threat to the United States. And I proposed certain modifications to the proposal. Still, programmers didn't like being told what to say or what to do. They wanted to have a free rein on what topics to cover and how much of it and so forth. So you know, the effort was, the overall effort was, and it still is, to begin to spread across the Western Hemisphere, joining forces with other media outlets from Latin America and the Caribbean, and of course United States and Canada, those that want to join us, to create an alternative news media network, video, print, audio, you name it. So in terms of a crisis, whether it's a hurricane or an earthquake or, God forbid, a coup d'etat, that we can get specific information without the skewed and twist of the corporate media that is obsessed about promoting wars. And that's at the long term, but at the short term of it, it's happening March 25th, one whole day. Each different programs will address different areas, different topics that they consider that important. And, well, we're looking forward to it. Other cyber radio stations want to take our signal, KPFK signal, and rebroadcast it through their own media, some in Mexico, some here in the U.S. So as a start, or I should say as a phase two of our effort to link up with alternative media in the continent, things are looking up.
So historically, one of the problems in Latin America generally, and in the United States for that matter, is that the bulk of the media is in the control of large corporations. The media outlets you're working with, however, are not of that model. The construction of this network in a world that now has Telesur in it, what kind of promise do you think that has in terms of getting this kind of information around?
Well, there have been made in the past, other people have made the effort to do so, some of them more successful, for example, the FARCO, FARCO network in Argentina, you know, has hundreds of radio stations. It's just pretty effective, one of the best networks in the Western Hemisphere and in the world, for that matter. Then you have the Latin American Association of Educational Radio, ALER, out of Quito, Ecuador, that manages to link up radio stations from Peru, the Caribbean, all the way down to South America, also successful in their own terms. And then you have two other national networks operating in Bolivia. Then you have two other networks, one operating in El Salvador and one in Guatemala. So they're kind of loose and disconnected, but at the moment of a crisis, if we do need them, we can link them up together just to get reliable information on whatever is happening. Those are limited in scope. What I envision is video, print, and audio combined, flowing in all directions, so we can all stop being so dependent on mass media that it's like a branch of the U.S. military of the NATO alliance that is obsessed about selling wars to the population and ignoring very important movements such as the Bolivarian Revolution, the Citizens' Revolution in Ecuador, the incredible social experiment, building a very, very just society that includes everyone that is going on in Bolivia, and the alternative media regulations have coming out of Ecuador and Argentina, which are very, very cool, very progressive, very advanced. They are totally ignored by the mass media, and that's not good. That's not good for the overall population of the world, because there are other options. There are other ways to do media, and, you know, we aspire to get that message across with the help of our friends. So our peoples are much better informed and are in a better position to make wise decisions towards leaning, hopefully, towards a more participatory democracy where the system is more inclusive and more horizontal.
Here in the United States, everyone, I think, is familiar with the emergency broadcast system, which intervenes into what any television or radio program you might be listening to from time to time. With the process of integration that's been ongoing now in Latin America and the Caribbean, and the threat, yet again restated last week by President Obama, to Venezuela, which is at the heart of that, do you see yourself building, or do you see this project as helping to advance a sort of emergency broadcast system for the entire hemisphere?
Well, I see myself as I'm already part of that system, part of this growing network, because I do present proposals, I do pursue initiatives, and I do have lots of friends in different countries. And there, you'll be surprised how many people would love to see this construction of what is called in south of the border La Patria Grande, the big, great motherland, a country that where international borders are more cosmetic than anything else, because of people realize that one of the most important assets in the world is people, and therefore you are in a different frame of mind where you can expand your network based on equality of rights, and media should definitely be at the center of that.
And finally, given the current situation with the United States looking like it's preparing to attack Venezuela, what do you think people should be doing in terms of you know, reaching out to each other to try to exchange information and mobilize themselves in the, you know, to defend Venezuela?
Well, I suggest that people truly understand the incredible changes that have been made in Venezuela in the last 12, 15 years or so, in which women, the elderly, children, Mother Nature have much better rights, the labor force, while the capitalist system is taking away money from the workforce, reducing the power, what people can do with their salary, and basically cutting wages across the board. In Venezuela, they're increasing the wages for the labor force. They have in the legislation protection for the environment, protection for Mother Nature, something that is a must, something that belongs to the future, and it's something that's being also repeated in Ecuador and Bolivia. But in the case of Venezuela, as of now, as we speak, the Venezuelan government has launched a worldwide campaign to pressure Barack Obama to annul, to cancel the executive order he signed a few days ago, in which he declares Venezuela an unusual, extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States. And this is happening as we speak. People can join that mass international movement. People can become familiar with all the great things that are happening in terms of social advances, how real progress is happening in Venezuela, and understand the dynamics of grassroots movements in terms of how they were able to construct from the ground up a constitution that represents all the different segments of the population, all the different groups and the different regions of the country, which is very extraordinary, very unusual, very advanced, and see how Venezuela helps African Americans and Native Americans in the United States, how Venezuela supports, subsidizes oil for many countries in Central America and the Caribbean, so other people can be are in a better position to put better quality of food and education and housing to their population. And that's wonderful. I think once people begin to understand all this incredible phenomenon that is happening south of the border, people will have a much different perspective than what they can get if they only watch CNN and BBC and Associated Press and Reuters and Yahoo News all the time. I suggest people just get better informed.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.